This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Professor Stephen Zeidman joins us to talk about the denial of parole for Judy Clark.
She has served 35 years in prison. Even Governor Cuomo, who went to the prison to meet her and gave her clemency, wanted her to get out, but the parole board again said no.
Giving us a broader perspective on the epidemic of aging persons in prison is Laura Whitehorn.
Prisons in New York State and around the country, because the United States holds 2.3 million people in prison, are turning into old age homes.
We'll hear a speech from Chris Hedges, given at the recent memorial for attorney Lynn Stewart in New York City.
In an afternoon of extraordinarily moving speeches, this, I thought, was the finest.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The United States of America imprisons a higher proportion of its population than any other country in the world. Today, America holds 2.3 million people behind bars. This has been called mass incarceration. Part of the reason for mass incarceration is the system of parole, which many consider to be broken, especially in New York State. The purpose of incarceration is punishment. It is also rehabilitation. And third, it's an opportunity for a person to come to terms with what she did and gain skills. This is why prisons are called correctional facilities. When a person has repaid society for a crime, has been rehabilitated, and does not pose a threat to the community, they are supposed to be paroled. But in actuality, this is not the way it works. In many cases, especially when the applicant for parole had committed a violent crime, the sole criteria that the parole board examines is the nature of the crime that was committed, something that the convict cannot change. The latest example is the denial last month of parole to 67-year-old New York prisoner Judy Clark, who's been behind bars for 35 years for her role in driving the getaway car in the bungled 1981 Brinks armored car robbery, which left two Nyack, New York police officers dead, as well as the truck driver. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, in granting Judy Clark clemency so that she would be eligible for parole, said, "It was a hard political decision. I could hear Jimmy Breslin's voice saying, 'She made a mistake. We all do. She learned. She paid the price. She spent her life in a cage, and she is now different. Jesus would pardon her. Who the hell made you better than Jesus?'" A prominent local police chief, Joseph Sinigara, commented that, "I don't care what kind of model prisoner she was." Ms. Clark's daughter, Harriet, said she understood the seriousness of the crime, but believed the decision by the board was an injustice. "My mother did not kill anyone," she said, "and it's hard for me to understand who is served by making her die in prison, which is what decisions like this eventually amount to." We are joined today by two guests. Ex-political prisoner Laura Whitehorn, who served 14 years for the destruction of government property in connection with a number of bombings where no one was injured. She was released in 1999. Ms. Whitehorn is a leader in the Release Aging People in Prison organization, RAP, and has been active in challenging the New York State Parole Board's intransigence. We are also joined by Judy Clark's attorney, Professor Stephen Zeidman, who is the director of the Criminal Defense Clinic at CUNY Law School in New York City. Professor Zeidman graduated Duke University School of Law and is a former staff attorney and supervisor at the Legal Aid Society. Professor Zeidman is a member of the American Bar Association's Criminal Justice Section Council and also serves on the board of directors of Prisoners Legal Services.
Steve Zeidman, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good morning.
The parole board voted unanimously against parole for Judy Clark, ruling that it would send the wrong message to law enforcement and was incompatible with the welfare of society. Governor Cuomo visited Judy in prison and said, quote, "No one could be more rehabilitated," and that, quote, "She has made exceptional strides in self-development." Tell us, please, what the law is with respect to parole, and is what Governor Cuomo said irrelevant?
Well, let me take those in order. The law of parole, and that might be part of the problem, the law is opaque. It's pretty much unregulated. It allows the parole board to do what the parole board thinks is appropriate. It is, in my 30 years of working in criminal justice, I don't think I can point to another system that is as suffering from a lack of transparency and standards that are reviewed on a regular basis by courts and other bodies. But having said that, there are basic rules and regulations. There are a series of factors for the parole board to look at. Governor Cuomo, when he was considering clemency for Judy Clark, actually looked at many of the same factors and came to the conclusion that you said, that she was one of the very few people who, in his mind, merited the extraordinary remedy of clemency. How and why the parole board chooses to come to a different conclusion, I think all you have to do is look at the composition of the parole board and read, not even between the lines of their decision, but just read their decision carefully, and you get a sense of what matters to the parole board.
Can Judy appeal this denial of parole?
Yes. Well, it's two ways. One, there's an administrative appeal, which goes right to the parole board. So the question is whether members of the parole board are going to carefully and thoroughly and frankly courageously review a decision of three of their own. But thereafter, then we get into court. Then we get into New York State Supreme Court in a proceeding called an Article 78 proceeding, where a judge will finally look at the standards that exist and determine whether or not the parole board's ruling followed their own rules and regulations.
Steve, in addition to the local and state law enforcement groups, Judy Clark's release was also opposed by the Republican state senators, and nearly 10,000 people signed a petition urging the State Board of Parole to keep her behind bars. What did the people supporting Judy do to counter this?
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about the parole board. I mean, the decision is clearly, it's motivated. It gives not only undue weight, it gives total weight to law enforcement. It gives total weight to a group that's calling for interminable, relentless punishment. And Judy's case is not alone in that regard. In particular, a crime of violence, in particular, if a victim in any way, shape, or form happens to be a member of law enforcement, this is the support they galvanize. It's email, it's pressing a button, say, I want my name, you can put my name on this, and we call it 10,000 people oppose release. But in contrast, and this gets right to the heart of the decision, they refer to this one line about Judy being a symbol of terroristic crime. And I think they're right that Judy is, in fact, a symbol, but she's a symbol of transformation, a symbol of hope, redemption, the capacity for profound and meaningful change, as reflected in the thousands of letters that we submitted, people who just wrote on their own. And I'm talking, this is a wide swath of the community. Ordinary folks in New York, across the country, clergy, lawyers, social workers, teachers, currently and formerly incarcerated at women who write powerfully about Judy's impact on them, people who work inside Bedford, members of Congress. I mean, I could go on. And in fact, there are even letters of support from people inside the NYIAC New York community where the crime occurred. So there were thousands, if not petitions, these were individually written letters that the parole board chose to ignore and instead cast their lot with calls for interminable punishment.
The chief of police in Saugerties,
yep,
called, the man's name is Sinagra, and he called Judy truly a domestic terrorist. And he said, I don't care what kind of model prisoner she was. The people she murdered don't get to come back into society, nor should their murderer. And then another chief of police, the head of the sheriffs in Ulster County, a guy named Van Blarkum, said, mm-hmm, what Cuomo did represented offended law enforcement and undermines law enforcement, and he represents a pattern of behavior we're no longer going to stand for. That kind of mobilization on behalf of the law enforcement people, as opposed to prisoners, I mean, what kind of constituency do prisoners make up? They don't even vote.
That's true. However, you know, if you want examples, I mean, we can look at the Close Rikers movement here in New York City, which to a great extent was led by community groups, led by people who were formerly at Rikers Island, who can attest to what it was like. So there is, you know, there is a groundswell of support. There is a movement. But sure, politicians right now, I think the parole board is a classic example of the way the politicians, the parole board, are deferring and kind of giving in to what the police community wants. Let me just give you one example, too, about that idea of Judy as a domestic terrorist, or that idea in the parole board, which they just kind of pull that language and say she's a symbol. There are two issues about that. The first and primary one, just it flies in the face of what parole is supposed to do. Parole, you are incarcerated. Let's say you get 25 to life. You serve 25 trying, I mean, no one would deny, difficult years. And then you come up for the parole board, and the question is, how have you lived your life for the last 20 years? How have you managed? And so many people have thrived, have done remarkable things, and the issue can't be, well, what happened 25 years ago? Then what's the point of having parole and a parole board? And in Judy's case, if you think about it, taking it one step further, this idea that she's a symbol. Well, the parole board says come back in 2 years. What, if anything, can she possibly do to change that? It's looking backwards again. It's inappropriate. The larger question is, who is the person she is today? And she is a very different and a very compelling person, as the governor himself saw. And by the way, let me just add, the governor's determination was years in the making. There was an executive clemency bureau that vetted materials for years. And so the idea that the parole board in a period of 2 weeks somehow has greater insight is ludicrous.
Can you speak to the issue of how the United States ranks with comparable countries with respect to our long sentences and parole?
Sure. The United States is so out of step with other industrialized nations that it's you can't exaggerate it. I'll give you one example. My friend Mark Maurer from the Sentencing Project, who has pointed out that most other comparable countries have a 20-year maximum for any crime, and he has testified to that fact and urged in Congress that should be the maximum for any crime in this country. And just focusing on New York State, rather than a 20-year maximum, we have about 9,000 people serving sentences of a 20-year minimum. We have another 9,000 people serving sentences with a lifetime maximum. So we are completely out of step. We are so much more punitive and motivated by vengeance than other countries throughout the world. It can't be overstated.
And how does New York State compare to other states?
You know, it's people these days, everyone talks about whether it's Rikers Island or New York State prisons, the drop in the number of people who are incarcerated, and that's true. But it's really, we haven't addressed the harder question about people who have served decades for admittedly violent crime. Those folks are still serving interminable, relentless sentences. They see the parole board, like Judy. Judy is not alone, and the parole board just wants to talk about what happened 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, and they remain incarcerated. There's no threat to public safety. People have done remarkable things with their lives, but New York State, through its parole board, is as punitive as any other place in the country.
Steve, let me ask you about Judy. What was it like when you met her for the first time? What's she like, and what did you learn about her?
It was extraordinary to meet Judy. I met her, it was the summer 2 years ago. And to sit and talk to someone who has persevered, maintained hope, optimism, generosity over 36 years of incarceration is truly remarkable. And similar to the governor, I found Judy to be very open, candid. She was not hiding anything, willing to talk about her life, the crime of conviction. She wasn't sugarcoating. And ultimately, you come away from meeting her, you're very inspired. You're filled with hope for the human capacity for change. You know, so as a footnote, I should add, Judy also happens to be a very warm, funny, caring person. So the time goes by very quickly. But how you can maintain that after, you know, going on four decades of incarceration is remarkable and inspiring. From my perspective, it's what she has done for and on behalf of others. So the college program that's now at Bedford, and there were a bunch of women at Bedford who advocated when Pell Grants were taken out of the prisons to say we should have college program here in Bedford, and there is. There's an AIDS program that Judy and others developed inside Bedford for the benefit of everybody inside Bedford, teaching classes in the nursery for others, working with prison administration and staff. So to me, that's her accomplishments are not only what she has done, you know, for herself, but for others. You know, and frankly, there are letters The question earlier about letters and how did we counter some of the opposition, there must have been 35 or 45 letters from women either currently incarcerated at Bedford or formerly who talk much more eloquently than I can about what Judy has accomplished or what she has done for them, caring for them, advising them, guiding them, tending to them, urging them to think about who they are and who they can become. So the impact of her being denied parole, it reverberates. It's not just Judy and her family and so profoundly disappointing, but it's also the message that it says to all the other women in Bedford, to everybody else who is incarcerated, about it. The message it sends is, you know what, no matter what you do, we are going to turn a blind eye on the parole board if there's enough law enforcement opposition, and we're just going to look back 35 years and say, you need to serve more time.
And let's talk for a moment about the aging prison population. In this state, approximately how many prisoners are there over the age of 50?
I believe there are probably close to 8,000 over 50 and maybe another 2,000 to 3,000 over 60. Put another way, in New York State, I think it's about a fifth of the people in prison are over the age of 50. And every study ever done shows there is virtually no risk to public safety in the overwhelming number of those 10,000 people.
And conversely, in New York, is it accurate that 16-year-olds can be tried as adults?
Currently, yes, though there is, we did have a, there was a raise the age legislative change, so we are seeing some movement in that regard. Nowhere near enough, but I guess change is incremental.
Right.
Since most prisoners in the United States are state prisoners, not federal prisoners, what do you think can be done on a state level? What kind of leadership do we need? How can we change this?
Yeah, the leadership at the state level is so critical. President Obama and his clemency initiative, and believe me, it's wonderful that if I think it was 2,000 or 2,500 people that he granted clemency to, but it's a drop in the bucket. You just think all 50 states, all the governors have the power to grant clemency, all of them. Just imagine if we thought, aren't there 100 people serving sentences in each state who really shouldn't be there? I mean, 100, I'm trying to make it easy on the governors. There are countless more, but if you just do the math, state by state, there could be a dramatic impact if governors and the states took the initiative.
Steve, you've written that the American justice system is excessively punitive and that it's based on retribution and punishment rather than rehabilitation. Why do you think this is? How have we gotten here?
Well, I think to a large degree, it's people's reaction to crime in general. On a more macro level, it's about locking up black and brown people and throwing away the key. But once you're incarcerated, you are viewed as disposable. Certainly, you know, someone asked me the other day, I was just thinking about the criminal justice system and going back to this idea, and forgive me if this just seems too much of a stretch, but the idea of Lincoln's inaugural address, thinking about the better angels of our nature. Well, if anything is the opposite of the better angels of our nature, it's criminal justice. There is a seemingly unquenchable thirst for vengeance, and it starts at the trial level, and it goes all the way up to the appellate courts and ultimately to parole. It is just grounded in this idea that you committed a crime, you deserve to be locked up, throw away the key, we don't want to hear from you. And that's how we've gotten to, you know, the 2.2 million people who are incarcerated.
In Norway, several years ago, this madman murdered over 60 children and was sentenced to 20 years in prison. How did Norwegian culture develop to that point, and how did American culture develop to the point of where we are? It's a very broad question, but it's something that, that I don't know how to come to terms with, other than the notion that this country was grounded in slavery.
And I think that's the only conclusion you can come to. And if you want, you know, there are people who think about criminal justice and sentencing in a more academic sense, but even those folks, the question is, where is rehabilitation? And where is punishment? And all the theories of why somebody is sentenced and punishment has just so dominated the American landscape that it's been virtually impossible to unplug it. There aren't enough politicians saying, you know, I want to rethink how long someone must serve for a violent crime. No one wants to go near it. And so the punishment paradigm, it's been there for a long time. It exists. We talk about the problem with mass incarceration, but are doing virtually nothing to fully address it. You know, and Michael, I should add, that idea of a 20-year maximum in Norway for that kind of crime, I mean, understand, when people hear that in the United States and they think, that's outrageous, what if he's still dangerous? Well, there's an opportunity at the end of 20 years, if the government can show that he still presents a present danger of violence to others, they can make that argument, and that man could remain incarcerated for another, I believe it's another year, where there's another opportunity for him to argue for his release and for the government to present evidence, not just an intuition, but real evidence. We are so far away from that, it's almost unimaginable.
Steve Seidman, we're coming to the end of our allotted time, unfortunately. How can people learn more about Judy Clark, what she's like, and what they can do to support her?
They should look at, number one, they should look at the parole decision. I urge people who are interested in Judy Clark's case and parole generally to read the decision of the parole board so you get a sense of what Judy faces and what everybody who's coming up for parole faces. In Judy's case, there's a website as well. There's incredible amounts of support. You can reach us at letters@judithclark.org, and we will respond to your questions. And join the thousands of people who are urging the parole board, who urge the governor to grant clemency, and are urging the parole board to release Judy Clark after 36 years.
As we conclude, can you just clarify the length of Judy's term, how much she served already?
Sure. One of the things that those opposed to Judy's release, frankly, the only issue they have raised is that she should be punished. She needs to be punished. And we should all be very clear that Judy's in her 36th year of incarceration. She is the third longest serving woman in New York State prison. She is one of the oldest women in New York State prison. So she has been severely punished already. We're not talking about someone getting a, quote, the proverbial slap on the wrist. Judy, like so many others who are up for parole, have served decades.
Steven Seidman, it's been an honor to have you on. We're a fan of your work, and thank you so much.
Steve, I hope that when you come back the next time, you've got some good news for us. And thanks again for being a guest on Law and Disorder.
All right, thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Laura, you've been sitting in on our interview with Steve Seidman and Judy Clark's case. Can you put her case in the context of the bigger picture?
Well, I can try. First of all, Steve's right. Judy has enormous support from the other women that she's been in prison with. And that in itself is emblematic of many, many thousands of people in the New York State prisons. Her case is almost a mirror image of so many other cases. There are, at this moment, we don't have the new figures, but as of January 1st, 2016, there were 10,140 people, 50 years and older, in the New York State systems. And as Steve said, that's about 20% of the prison population. And that number has increased by 98% since the year 2000, at the same time as the overall prison population in New York has fallen by almost 30%. And Judy's case is very similar to many of the people who are over 50, including in the New York State system, her co-defendant, David Gilbert, who has exactly the same sentence and exactly the same kind of support, love, and record of not just accomplishments, but giving to the community and being a leader in his community. He, along with Mujahid Farid, who is the founder of Release Aging People in Prison RAP, started the first HIV/AIDS program after Kwesi Balogun died of AIDS in the New York State system, right before, actually, the Bedford women did the same thing. Only the difference was that David got shipped out as punishment and sent around to other prisons. But and Mutulu Shakur in the federal system, who's also connected with Judy's case, who just got turned down for parole in the feds and has to do another 15 years before he goes back. There, of those 10,000-plus people in prison over the age of 50, so many of them have gone to the board for so many years. About 5 years ago, I did crunched some numbers, which I'm not very good at, but I had help. And there were, at that point, 100 people, 50 and older, who had gone to the board for 20 years and more and been turned down. So what we're talking about is a systemic problem. And with RAP, we do support individual cases. We write for people like Judy. We write for many, many people to the board. But we feel that there's an institutional and activist component that has to be in our work also, because there are people in the state of New York that we can reach and talk to who can change this. So about a month ago, the state controller, Thomas DiNapoli, felt he had to issue a report talking about the number of aging people in New York State prisons. And people can read that report. And he says over and over again, one of the ways this can be dealt with is by release for certain people who don't pose a risk to public safety. And with the parole board's way of judging who is a risk, most of those older people qualify as almost no risk to public safety. So Thomas DiNapoli, who's a state controller, he's not involved directly in justice issues around the prisons. He did something. So then what happened? Eric Schneiderman, the attorney general, was forced to make a statement also. And he said very kind of briefly, well, that's why I support compassionate release. However, what RAP and other people are saying is that Eric Schneiderman, as the attorney general, he represents the parole board. So when Steve talks about filing an Article 78 appeal, when he does that, who will argue the other side and defend the parole board is members of Mr. Schneiderman's staff. So RAP met with a number of state senators last year, and about 5, 6, 7 of them, I think, and some city council people, wrote to Eric Schneiderman and asked him to issue what's called an advisory opinion directing the parole board to follow the law. And as Steve said, it's very opaque, and they have a lot of room, but there is law, and a law was changed in 2011 to direct them to use risk and needs assessments to say why someone should not get out of prison. If someone is very low on the risk scale, why aren't they releasing them? So the government was saying to them, go by risk and needs assessment and release people when they don't pose a risk. So the state senators were asking the attorney general to issue an advisory opinion directing the parole board to follow the law. And he has to this day not done it, but he spoke up after DiNapoli's thing. So we're saying that all the state elected officials in the legislature, the appointed ones on the parole board, this is in their hands. They can make a difference. And we sit here and we talk about 2.3 million people locked up and the number of people in New York State. We have the power of the people, but the elected officials have the actual power of government to make a difference. So we are challenging the attorney general and every other elected official to do the right thing and to say the people of New York are tired of this punitive system and would like to see a change. You can do it.
Laura, what is the cost of keeping an older person in prison compared with a younger one? And do you think, in the long run, practical considerations may factor into releasing them?
Well, I do think that that is important because programs need money. So social programs on the street need money, and that money's going into the prison system. It costs between 2 and 4 times as much to incarcerate an older person. And in the state controller's report, he says the Department of Corrections doesn't give these numbers out. They don't keep track. Fareed, whom I work with, says what gets measured gets done. So we are arguing that the Department of Corrections should make an audit of the amount of money that they're spending on elderly people in the state system. And by the way, Governor Cuomo, who in 2016 started the year by saying we have to raise the number of people getting parole because it's miserable in this state, 80% of people who go to the parole board get turned down. And that number is the same for all age groups, pretty much the same, which means that they're really not looking at risk because a long-termer, the lowest risk of recidivism is a long-term incarcerated person who committed murder. Those are exactly the people they're not letting out. Yeah. So they have to look at how much is this costing, this policy. And it's costing about 2 to 4 times, which means that the average cost of keeping an elderly person in the system in New York must be at least $100,000.
I read that the average prisoner, not necessarily old, just average prisoner, costs $60,000 a year. So it must be much more than 60 for an older person with health problems.
Yes, and New York State has a slightly higher, spends slightly higher on each incarcerated person than other states. You know, we're supposed to be progressive. But, you know, and the money argument is important. That's why the comptroller wrote his report, because he's responsible for that kind of stuff. But I think that there's a deeper issue, which is, what is the robbing of dignity to keep a person in prison as they age and go through all of the physical problems that come with age? I mean, someone from the Osborne Association, who's gone into the different prisons for many years, talked about seeing people who have dementia and couldn't even play bingo. And yet, those people are being kept in prison. And there's something, what is that, an emblem of our society with nursing homes behind bars? So Cuomo said in 2016, let's get more people out on parole. In 2017, he dealt with the same issue of the rising number of elders in prison by saying, let's expand the medical units for elders. Geriatric units behind, that's why RAP started. We saw across the country there were articles in every major newspaper saying, look at the number of elders in prison. It's rising and rising and rising. We have to build geriatric units. We have to build nursing homes inside. And we said, why? Let them go. That's why, you know, we have this slogan, if the risk is low, let them go. And that's what we're saying. We see those decisions over and over again, and they read very much like Judy's. And the issue in these decisions is that the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association and other law enforcement organizations have a much more robust influence on the parole board than the people. So that goes without saying. It's shown over and over again. They have a list of people. People don't know who they're writing a letter about, but they just push a button and it says, don't let this person out of prison. What we need is the commissioners to be removed, and we need better commissioners to be appointed. So, by the way, people always ask us this, how many commissioners? Well, by law, there should be 19. How many are there now? 12. Judy Clark had a 7.5-hour interview. Most people have 5 minutes and it's all, by the way, on video. It's not in person. There are commissioners who were appointed by Governor Pataki, who everyone knows was lock them up and throw away the key, permanent punishment poster child, and they are still on the board. And we are saying that there should, first of all, we need the full complement of 19. There are 12 now. And we need people who represent something other than the upstate law enforcement community. The New York Times did a huge story about the racism of the parole system in New York. And that is also true, that there is a total, you know, a whiteout in how decisions are meted out. We want to see a full complement of commissioners. We want to see commissioners who are social workers. On rapcampaign.com, we have a member who's a social worker, and she wrote a blog about why social workers should be on the parole board. And it gets to the issue of what should the parole board be doing? They should be looking at who the person is now, not who they were when they were 19.
I understand that when Governor Cuomo attempts to put somebody on the parole board, he's blocked by the Republicans in the state legislature.
And that's partly because of the Independent Democratic Caucus, or whatever it's called, committee. Those Democrats led by Jeff Klein who vote with the Republicans. Yes, we see that. But, you know, there is pressure that can be brought by the Democratic the Democratic members of the legislature, and Governor Cuomo can go there and stand on the floor of the legislature and talk about it. I mean, there are many ways that they can get around this. They just, it's part of the problem, is that a lot of elected officials kind of say, it's out of our hands, we can't do anything. Well, then let's fix the system, if that's true. So one of the issues you asked before about the raise the age, and one of the issues about the change that happened in the budget negotiations with raise the age, is that there was an exclusion of kids convicted of violence. And we, RAP, and many other people around the country are looking at the issue of how can prison change happen? How can we decarcerate? How can we lower the number of people in prison? How can we shorten sentences? And too many of the people who are doing that, talking about that, talk about, well, let's let the low-risk, non-violent, the non-non-nons, non-violent, non-risk, non-sex offender. And so a lot of legislation that gets drafted immediately cuts out people convicted of violence. And we will never change the fundamental nature of the prison system if we don't look at how this country looks at violence. I mean, they look at violence very differently when it's carried out by a representative of a state organization, such as the police, from when it's carried out by an individual. So that's one thing. The other thing is that we've gotten into this situation because many things that aren't even really violent are categorized in our legal codes as violent. And why did that happen? It happened based on one after another case. Someone commits a horrendous crime, and the politicians rush to pass a law. You can't legislate individual activity that way. We can never do away with all risk. We can't do away with all damage to our communities, but we can figure out better ways of dealing with it.
What governs these legislatures is nothing but fear. But, Laura, I understand that you have the statement that Judy Clark's daughter, Harriet, wrote in support of her mother. And I wondered whether you could read that for us.
Yeah, I want to read it because Harriet knows that, just like Judy, there are, you know, there are other people, and especially people convicted of acts that happened in a political context, like Herman Bell and Jaleel Muntakim in the state system, and Robert Seth Hayes, who've actually done 45 years and more. So these lengthy sentences are typical. Or a man named John McKenzie, who just died by suicide last year after his 10th turn down by the board. He was 70 years old, and he had already served 40 years, and his daughter has become an advocate for change in the parole system. So the children are really affected. So I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'll just read part of it. Harriet wrote, "Parole decisions that fail to take rehabilitation into account are their own kind of violence and create their own kind of terror. There is no reason to bring someone up for parole if there is nothing they can do to earn parole. The parole board should be ashamed of the message they've sent to people on the inside and their loved ones on the outside. So I want to send a different message and say how proud I am of the men and women inside who, under inhumane conditions, work so hard to transform their lives and deserve a parole system worthy of their efforts. My mother is not a symbol, but the dysfunctional and merciless parole board is, unfortunately, a symbol of the racism, classism, and immorality rampant in our criminal justice system."
Thank you, Laura Whitehorn. Could you please tell our listeners how they can get a hold of RAP and learn more about what you folks are doing?
Yeah. I want to make one other point, too, is that, you know, we hear a lot about that, and Steve talked about this, that the murdered people can't come back and that the victims' families don't want the person convicted of the crime to get out. But the reason we have a system of laws is to prevent a vengeance-based society where a victim of crime gets to determine what happens in that anger. We have laws that mediate these things, and that's the point of parole. A parole board should be carrying that out. So we do believe that the people of New York really don't want vengeance anymore. And so we're asking people to join us on May 10th in Albany on a day of protest and advocacy, and people can find that and all this other information at rapcampaign.com. That's RAPP campaign RAP.com, and RAP stands for Release Aging People in Prison.
As always, Laura, it's a pleasure to have you on. We wish you continued good luck in your work, and you serve as an inspiration to us.
Thanks, and I'll see you in Albany when we go up on May 10th. I'm sure you guys will all be there.
That would be great.
Thank you, Laura.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
As our listeners know, Lynn Stewart passed away several months ago. Chris Hedges spoke at the Lynn Stewart Memorial in April in St. Peter's Church in New York City. We want to share his remarks with you. Let's have a listen.
Those who spend a lifetime resisting are long-distance revolutionaries are often couples. I discovered this in wartime. For to resist day after day, month after month, year after year, in a nation convulsed by the poisons of nationalism, racism, and militarism is lonely, tiring, and dangerous. It is to be rejected and demonized by the dominant culture. A celebration of the life of Lynn Stewart is a celebration of the life of Ralph Pointer and a celebration of their family. Lynn would never have been Lynn without Ralph, and Ralph would never have been Ralph without Lynn. And the love that sustained them was the love they turned with such ferocity outwards on a loveless world of injustice, racism, poverty, capitalist exploitation, and state violence. And there are no shortage of agents of this loveless world who were knocked off balance when hit by the blast furnace of Lynn Stewart and Ralph Pointer. There is nothing moral about condemning a crime of history, although there are no shortage of individuals and institutions that have claimed the mantle of morality by rooting themselves in an atrocity of the past to ignore the atrocities of the present. The moral life is attained by condemning and fighting the crimes of the present, which, as we know from the mutations of white supremacy, is usually the newest iteration of the crime of history dressed up in new clothing. Lynn was for this reason an exemplar of what it means to live the moral life. What drives this life? Knowledge, certainly, an understanding of systems of oppression and how they work, courage, tenacity, anger, For how can you walk out of the American inner cities and the American gulags and not be angry? But I would say the heart of this life is a deep and profound capacity for empathy. The sadness and distress that comes when you see people suffer. Lynn spoke about her own epiphany as a nice, white, middle-class girl from Queens who went to work as a librarian in 1962 in Harlem, which, although Queens was 5 miles away, she said she did not know existed. And in the Harlem school system, her epiphany was triggered by the cruelty to children. And there was someone else in that school incensed by this cruelty, the teacher and union organizer across the hall from the school library, Ralph Pointer, whose alacrity at making common cause with Lynn was probably aided, as Lynn said, by the fact that at that time her skirt was as short as her hair was long. Lynn wrote a letter to the parents of the school that said, "You're constantly told that your children can't learn. Your children doesn't learn. But what you don't know is every other child's mother is being told the same thing. And actually, all these children can learn, but you're caught up in the system." And Ralph distributed the letter in front of the school and called for a meeting. And Ralph, not for the first time, was fired. And that triggered their fight for community schools. There may have been 6 kids to support, and Lynn may at the time have been the only wage earner. But when she said to Ralph she wanted to go to law school, Ralph said, "Well, I guess you better go then." And she went to, as she said, fight government on behalf of someone who didn't really have the tools or wherewithal to do that, and to be able to go home and look at myself in the mirror. The movements in the 1960s briefly created a better legal system, not a fair one, but not one so overtly prejudiced against the poor. A right to an attorney, the dismissal of evidence and an illegal search. But the elites steadily chipped away at these gains until they were once again wiped out, until once again a cop's word became law, even when it was obviously a lie. Lynn kept fighting, not winning so much anymore, but fighting. She defended the poor. She defended radicals. She defended all those the state were trying to crush and erase. And then she took the case of Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, who, and I speak now as the former Middle East Bureau Chief for the New York Times, had nothing to do with the 1993 attacks on the World Trade Center. But who was demonized as the face of terror by the government and the press. And in the end, the state not only lynched the sheikh whose sentencing saw Lynn weep in court, but lynched Lynn too. Not so much for defending the sheikh, but for spending years defending people like Larry Davis, a young black man who acted in his own self-defense against armed police. And she too was prosecuted in a show trial. A trial where she was open and vocal about her friendship with Mumia Abu-Jamal, because decent people do not deny their friends. And was disbarred and sent to prison. And then Lynn's family organized to shame the state to release her. To resist radical evil is to endure a life that, by the standards of the wider society, is a failure. It is to defy injustice at the cost of your career, your reputation, your financial solvency, and at times your life. It is to be a lifelong heretic. And perhaps this is the most important point. It is to accept that the dominant culture, even the liberal elites, will push you to the margins and attempt to discredit not only what you do, but also your character. For when you stand as Lynn Stewart did with the oppressed, you are treated like the oppressed. The great radical priest Daniel Berrigan told me that the essence of faith is the belief that the good draws to it the good. The Buddhists call this karma, but he said he did not know where it went. He trusted that it went somewhere. And we are called to do the good, or at least the good so far as we can determine it and then let it go. I saw in the conflicts I covered as a war correspondent the power of this faith, which lies outside any religious or philosophical creed. This faith is what Václav Havel called in his essay, The Power of the Powerless, Living in Truth. A life spent living in truth exposes the corruption, lies, and deceit of the state. It is a refusal to be part of the charade. And I saw how when the great resistors are taken from us, their nobility and courage shine on in the darkness, calling all of us to save ourselves, to save each other, and to save our souls. There will come a moment in your life when you will face your own fear. You will be forced to choose between standing with the oppressed or remaining silent. And you will think of Lynn, and she will be there. Her presence, her spirit, and you will do what is right because you cannot betray her. Because the cruelty around you demands that you respond no matter what the cost. And in the Christian faith, we call this resurrection. Thank you.
That was Chris Hedges speaking at the Lynn Stewart Memorial.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.